This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today, we talked to a researcher who looked at police fatal shootings. The reactions to the data are different depending on your perspective, such as...
Some people have latched on to one aspect of the results and said, you know, that's what we've said all along, was that it isn't about a particular police officer. It's the entire institution.
We hear from writer Keith Taylor, who's spending the summer on Isle Royale.
I don't worry about email. Nobody's texting me, or if they're texting me, I'm not getting them. You know, I'm not getting on Facebook. Yeah, I feel free of all that crap. It feels good.
We have an exit interview with Detroit's planning director. Then we hear about the musical group Moxie Strings.
The best compliment that we can get is that, you know, people heard us from afar and would never guess that it was only two people on stage.
And we've got a Cheers to Michigan cocktail for you.
And we're going to make a little Michigan twist on the most popular cocktail in Italy.
All of that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Let's talk about neighborhoods and public spaces. In Detroit, there are a lot of vacant lots in many neighborhoods, and the city has turned some of those vacant lots into public parks as part of a revitalization effort. Detroit has been making efforts in several neighborhoods since the city came out of bankruptcy and has begun to recover. Here to talk about how that's going is Detroit's director of the Planning and Development Department, Maurice Cox. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So I was reading a Knight Foundation report about a national initiative launched by that foundation and several others. Detroit is part of this reimagining the civic commons. How's that being done in Detroit?
Sure. The concept of reimagining the civic commons suggests that public life in neighborhoods could be uplifted, animated, if we were to reactivate the places where people traditionally gather in neighborhoods. In some cities, it's, you know, schools or libraries, it's buildings. But in Detroit, and specifically in the Fitzgerald neighborhood, it's the idea of gathering outdoors in a public park. In an area of the Northwest Detroit that really didn't have a active neighborhood serving park that families and kids could walk to within a 20-minute walk from their front door. So we took the abundance of vacant land parcels in the center of the Fitzgerald neighborhood. There were 26 parcels that had abandoned houses on them, overgrown lots, and we cleared that all and came up with 2.5 acres in the center of the Fitzgerald neighborhood. And these 2.5 acres cross streets and alleys. And the assignment was, could we turn these leftover parcels into a central park for the neighborhood? And today, that park exists, and it's an extraordinary asset to residents who live in that neighborhood.
Now, when you look at a neighborhood in Detroit, and they're all different, how do you decide, if this is going to work, we need to eliminate this, we need to change this, and this is okay? I mean, how do you go about making that assessment?
Sure. Well, we have varying degrees of occupancy and vacancy throughout the city. And often in some of the more densely populated areas, we still have vacant lots and vacant homes. So the Fitzgerald neighborhood, which is, as we're defining it, a quarter square mile neighborhood, it still has 600 households, families that still live there, but it had 100 vacant structures, and it had 300 vacant lots. So for us, that meant that there were 600 households who were still there, and that they deserved a public space as well. And we don't build a lot of new parks, but we have this extraordinary asset of hundreds of vacant lots. So this was our first experiment to see if we could just take vacant lots that are typical of so many Detroit neighborhoods and turn it into a real neighborhood asset. So we tend to look for areas that still have a core group of families in that area, but they don't have a neighborhood park. And in that is an opportunity for us to create these new neighborhood amenities like the Fitzgerald Park, Ella Fitzgerald Park.
You mentioned the 20-minute neighborhoods. Would you explain that for us?
Sure. It's a very simple concept that we borrowed from Portland, Oregon, that says residents of the city should be able to get 80% of their daily needs within a 20-minute walk of their home. And so that means you should be able to get to a neighborhood park. You should be able to jump on a greenway that takes you to other places that you'd like to go to in the neighborhood by foot or by bike. You should be able to walk to your own down neighborhood main street where you can go to a bakery or a cleaner's or a coffee shop or a sit-down family restaurant. You should be able to get to a variety of housing options, from apartments to traditional single-family detached housing, all within the same neighborhood geography. And so we have mapped the entire city of Detroit and found all of those places where we could guarantee those kind of amenities for the residents who stayed. And it has become a part of our strategic neighborhood fund. They're all neighborhoods that have a high degree of walkability, but a lot of these amenities that we're discussing were not readily available to residents. And after the set of strategies are in place, they will be.
How do you get the merchants and others needed to realize that goal to buy into the concept?
Well, it's not without some temporary pain, right? Because we have to, if we want to promote neighborhood shopping, we have to create an environment that people actually want to walk to and linger in. And so a lot of our commercial corridors over the years had been turned into like neighborhood speedways. It was mostly about getting through the neighborhood. And a lot of the businesses really faltered because they didn't have a really attractive, walkable area. So, you know, I think we can go to some of our neighboring cities and we can see some of these same commercial corridors, which have an enormous degree of pedestrian life. The shops are all filled, but that has not been Detroit's recent past. So our first pass was to remake a walkable shopping district in denser parts of the city. And we're doing it on Livernois right now, and soon we will be doing it on 6 Mile between Mary Grove College and UD Mercy. And this is the idea of making wider sidewalks so that you could have a kind of cafe life, outdoor cafe life, shade trees so that when people are walking, they are walking under a canopy of trees, bike lanes, cycleways that protect the cyclists from the travel lanes of cars by putting them up against the sidewalk, putting in ample parking, and all of these things slow traffic down so that motorists have an opportunity to see that there are viable businesses that they should be stopping and shopping at. And so Livernois is going through that process now. So it's really meant to reward the dozens and dozens of businesses that are on that corridor with a really strong pedestrian-friendly public realm. And we believe that's going to attract new businesses as well that will join those historic businesses. And the city is very intentional about creating, you know, the old-fashioned main streets that so many Detroiters know and love, where you knew the shop owner because they had been there for years. And through the Motor City Match program, which matches entrepreneurs with business ideas to real estate, we can begin to direct those Detroit-based entrepreneurs to these corridors to recreate the main street amenity that so many Detroiters remember and that we are now able to have again.
Let's talk about your future. I understand you're leaving Detroit to head up the planning department for Chicago. What's that going to mean for the long-term plans for Detroit's revitalization?
Well, we are fortunately have created these neighborhood plans, which have effectively pivoted from an exclusively downtown renaissance of Detroit to a neighborhood renaissance. And so each of the 10 neighborhoods that I've outlined in the Strategic Neighborhood Fund now have a plan to hold on to those residents who are there and get the amenities that they desired and worked towards actually implemented. So we have a pipeline of dozens of projects, streets, parks, housing rehab, and multifamily that are due to be constructed. Many are seven streetscapes will be under construction before the end of this year. A number of mixed-use affordable housing developments are also in the pipeline to be built in 2020. So I feel really confident that the roadmap for neighborhood revitalization is firmly in place, and we are not going to veer from that roadmap for years to come until it's completed. And so I can go to the next neighborhood revitalization assignment, which is an amazing opportunity in Chicago, knowing that Detroit created the template that now other cities are looking to emulate. And that's a wonderful, wonderful legacy to have of my time here in Detroit.
Maurice Cox has been the director of the City of Detroit's Planning and Development Department since 2015. Thanks for talking with us. Best of luck in Chicago.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Coming up next on Stateside, a writer from Michigan who's going to spend the summer on Isle Royale.
Then I'll eat lunch, and then I'll do some more work, and then I'll go canoeing, and I'll work while I'm in the canoe.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan writer and poet Keith Taylor is the artist in residence on the remote island park of Isle Royale. He returns to the island after 25 years away. He spoke with Stateside's Laura Weber Davis.
Keith Taylor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You know, as somebody who's never been to Isle Royale, no matter how long I've been living in this state, I guess it's surprising to some degree, but maybe not surprising at all. Please set the stage for me about what life looks like for you in your environs.
Well, Isle Royale's famously the least visited of the national parks in the lower 48, although it is the national park that has the most return visitors, the highest percentage of return visitors. It's very wild. There are 240 square miles. Its designation is wilderness. It is a unique landscape. Those of us who live in southern Michigan, we probably don't expect this. A lot of exposed rock, a lot of water. Of course, it's surrounded by Lake Superior, and a real interesting, albeit limited, population of beasts, most famous for its wolves and its moose. There's been an ongoing study for 70 years here of the relationship between the wolves and the moose. It's been beautiful here this week. I don't know how it's been in the rest of the state, but the skies are blue. Temperature for many people up here, it's too warm, around 80, and the nights have been calm, so quiet. They give me, for this artist in residence program, they give me a cabin way out on the isolated end of a point, one of the northeastern points of the island. And it is so quiet, Laura, you wouldn't believe it. It's just amazing. I sleep better here than I do anywhere else on the planet.
You know, that's interesting. Sometimes when I get out to the farther reaches and farther away from city lights, I feel like I can see from folk legend that upside-down bowl with the pinholes poked in it and all the light, the stars that shine down on me and how bright they are. Is that your experience? I imagine you just feel bathed in starlight at the end of the night.
It is. Although since the time I've been here, the moon has been very bright, other than certain parts of the night. So my wife and daughter were out soaking in that starlight. But yes, everything is very clear, and there's nothing off in the distance there except northern Ontario, where there are not a lot of people.
So I think you've struck at much of the heart of my next question, but what is it about Isle Royale that makes it the most revisited park in the nation?
Yeah, it's a tough question, and I've thought about this a lot. I am a returning artist in residence, and there haven't been very many of us yet. And, you know, I was desperate to get back here. I was so happy when they asked me to come. First of all, if you're comfortable in something that's designated as wilderness, so it is very wild, if you're comfortable without electricity, if you're comfortable without the usual contacts, if you're comfortable cleaning your own water and living that way, that itself is unique, and there's no way around it. But there's something about this landscape. It's an uplift landscape. These rocks lift at an angle out of Lake Superior, and the bays go in between the uplift rocks. It's a unique landscape. Nothing feels quite like it. And I don't like to go overboard or feel new agey about sacred landscapes, but there's something about Isle Royale that feels like a sacred landscape.
As an artist, how is it inspiring to you? What has it done to your work?
Well, I work consistently while I'm here. I mean, and I'm not quite sure why. I mean, that might be because I've agreed to this artist-in-residence program, so I feel the need to get something done to justify my existence. But I've had other kinds of appointments where I don't work as hard as I do here or as consistently as I work here. But I'm not quite sure what it is. I get up and I start writing at 6 o'clock in the morning and in my journal, and then I'll stop and try to turn something into a poem, and then I'll eat lunch, and then I'll do some more work, and then I'll go canoeing, and I'll work while I'm in the canoe. It's an amazing sort of level of intensity, and I know I'm not the only artist in residence who has worked that way here. Just about everybody I've talked to has worked consistently, no matter what medium they work in.
As a writer without internet or electricity, how are you writing? Are you using a typewriter or by hand? How are you doing it?
I'm writing by hand, yes. Long hand with a ballpoint pen and occasionally a pencil. Feels great.
Does it take some time for you to work up muscles in your hand? I feel like when I get handwriting sometimes, I just am reminded of how modern I am, how tired my hand gets.
Yeah, it's easier than typing. I mean, maybe it's because I'm old, Laura. Just sort of those muscles are the only muscles in my body that are in shape. Believe me, I've doing the hikes and doing the canoeing, I have felt those muscles, and they are not in shape.
Well, you wrote on Facebook before you left that your body isn't as supple and your mind isn't as supple as you when you were there 28 years ago. Well, I would already beg to argue to that second point.
Thank you.
But to the latter, I mean, I don't think there are many of us, despite our ages, that would be willing to take on this challenge. So I would say it's pretty admirable. Are you feeling the effects now, 28 years later? Does it feel different as an outdoorsman?
It does. And let me tell you a little story.
Sure.
There's a canoe here that they first had. Well, I was there here the first year, 1991. Wonderful canoe. It's a very well-done canoe. But it's light. And I'm a man of a certain size, and I'm significantly larger now than I was 28 years ago. And when I sit in the stern of that canoe, the front comes up, and it catches the wind. I had some trouble with that canoe and even wrote a poem about that 28 years ago. They still have the very same canoe. And it's like this canoe knew I'd written a bad poem about it, you know, and it got its revenge, and it caught the wind, and I went over, and I had a very cold swim in Lake Superior. Luckily, I had a life vest on. It was in an isolated spot, but there was a guy in a kayak who could get my canoe. Otherwise, I would have had a long, cold day. So, and it was partly because not only was I heavier in the canoe higher, but I wasn't as strong. I couldn't hold that canoe the way I could when I was younger than 40. So things change, and I have to adjust because I still expect that I can do these physical things. I try not to be too macho about them, but I have this expectations of my body, and my body did not meet that expectation. Luckily, I survived.
So the canoe was not a good friend to revisit.
No, but you know, what is that old thing? It's a shoddy craftsman who criticizes his tools. so I think that's it's not the canoe. And luckily, I survived.
Keith, for the rest of us who maybe feel intimidated by the idea of spending so much time alone or in nature, left to our own devices, what do you think is lost when we don't spend much time outdoors or when we aren't part of the natural world?
Yeah, Laura, that's a tough question. And I would like to do what I can to convince people not to be intimidated by it. And things are lost by people who don't do this. There's a certain confidence, self-confidence in face of the natural world. There's an appreciation of the natural world. Believe me, when I see a moose walking across the path in front of me, I feel it. I feel it viscerally. I feel it in my gut. You know, this is not a moose on television. This is the real thing. And that's an intensity that we don't get otherwise. I think it's worth a lot. If we could give this to some of the kids on my street in Ann Arbor, I would in a minute. Mm-hmm. But too many people are afraid of it, and they don't have to be. Just a little bit of common sense can get you here and give you an experience you would not get elsewhere, certainly not get elsewhere in the state of Michigan.
Keith Taylor, I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay amongst the beautifully indifferent cedar.
I will, and they are beautiful.
Well, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Great, and thank you very much.
The Moxie Strings have been electrifying classical music since they formed back in 2007. Fiddler Diana Ladio from Chelsea and cellist Allison Lynn from Grand Rapids met at Music Camp in Howell. Since then, they've recorded 3 full-length albums and just recently released their 4th album titled Breathe. The Moxie Strings are inspired not only to perform, but also to teach. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia takes it from here.
Diana Ladio, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, great to be here.
Diana, you play a contemporary 5-string violin. How does it compare to a regular violin?
I was a viola performance major in college at University of Michigan, and I have been playing the lower strings. Viola is basically the slightly larger, lower brother of the violin. And so it has 4 strings, specifically the low C string, and a violin has 4 strings, and has 3 strings in common with a viola, but also has a high E string. So this 5-string would be the combination of both, having both the low C and the high E. So when it comes to accompanying a cello, being there just 2 of us melody players in the band, accompanying the cello becomes much easier. Improvising, it kind of opens up a whole other world. So it's been an exciting move.
Well, let's take a listen to the track. This one is called Go in Beauty.
I love this melody because I feel like it was in the instrument already. I received this instrument. It was made, it's a brand new instrument made north of New York City. And when I picked it up and had the chance to sit and actually spend some time with it for the first time, this melody kind of spilled out. But what's different about this melody and why it celebrates the 5-string is that I can play the melody in 3 distinct voices, down low, in the middle, and then up on the high E string, which you wouldn't be able to do on just a viola or just a violin. You'd have to have both.
And I know Allison performs on a newly invented electric cello. What makes it special?
Yeah, the cello is made by an awesome instrument maker named Ned Steinberger, who started in the bass and guitar world and morphed into the electric strings world and is doing it really well. It's one of the more acoustic sounding. And I do think that that's kind of the goal for a lot of people is, even though you're electrified, you still would love to continue to have a beautiful tone. And this cello achieves that. It really does just look like a stick with strings. We get some really interesting guesses as to what it is on stage because it's not overly apparent at first glance. But because it's electrified, it does mean that we can do an immense amount of exciting sound effects, and basically anything an electric guitar can do, that's what we stay on stage, is available to us now. So, and she does.
Can you describe your music and then your shows and your performances?
Well, we have classical degrees, so there will always be elements of that in our playing. But our musical journey first took us into the Celtic and Irish worlds, which has been an amazing community to be a part of. And we were calling ourselves a Celtic band for quite a while. Since then, have kind of gone into the bluegrass, have dabbled in a lot of different rock sounds and electronic music. So we call it more contemporary strings now. We do some covers, about 80% original music. And so it's the melody is often played by the five-string violin and fiddle, whatever the melody may be. And then all of the accompaniment part is done on the cello. So she's basically our rhythm guitar and our bass guitar. And it's a pretty innovative way of kind of rock rhythmic accompaniment that it's pretty exciting. It makes for an exciting arrangement process.
Now, are there any challenges just being the two of you on strings?
Absolutely. Yeah. And we have played with lots of different people. Our good brother Fritz was our drummer for a long time, and we play with a couple other drummers now for bigger stages. But honestly, it's been a very fun challenge. And the best compliment that we can get is that, you know, people heard us from afar and would never guess that it was only two people on stage. And because the cello has such a beautiful kind of low end, and now with the five-string violin, we're finding that we can fill quite a lot of space.
You know, I imagine it's really fun to perform in front of a crowd and see them all up and moving and dancing with a lot of the music that you guys play. But on this new album, Breathe, the songs are slow songs. And I'm wondering what made you want to slow things down?
It became pretty apparent for us that music, our music in particular, was serving people in lots of different ways. But we were asked very often to have an album of slow tunes. And people would approach us after the show and asked us specifically what albums the slow tunes were on. And it was obvious that those were the ones that had left a real meaningful impact and that they wanted to potentially take home with them. And we were so thrilled to have the opportunity to maybe to sit and spend a little quiet time in the studio and think through slow tunes we had recorded in the past and also write some new things. And I think it opened our eyes as to why people would take music home with them or how music would serve them in their own personal space. And the chance to take a deep breath and have some quiet moments and breathe. And I think that it was powerful for us in that way as well.
Well, let's take a listen to another track. Can you choose one for us?
Oh, sure. Something a little different than Go and Beauty would be, well, Choose Joy is one that Allie wrote for her niece specifically. That would be one of the first couple of tracks on the album. And it's a nice eclectic mix. It's mostly her writing, and people have been responding really well to it.
So why did you choose this song?
Choose Joy is a nice example of the collaborative process. The first tune that we played, Go in Beauty, I would have written most of the melody to that. And this is a song that Allie would have brought to the table and wrote the melody for. And it's fun to bounce around ideas. And often you have a general idea of what you'd like to hear the other instrument playing, but the other person always brings kind of their own light and shine to it. And I think this is a really great example of that.
You started a nonprofit last year called The Mox Project. What's it about?
Yeah, well, we have been teaching clinics for quite a while, teaching workshops in schools, almost 10 years now, I would say. And we really, really enjoy that aspect of what we do. We basically introduce particularly classical string players, but we'll work with musicians and non-musicians alike. But the message being that there's a whole lot out there creatively that is available to students, specifically those that are going to grow up learning in the classical tradition. And we feel like we're very proud to be an illustration of that. So we do find, though, that our clinics tend to access a particular demographic of student. And it's often the ones that don't necessarily thrive in the classroom, specifically the music classroom, but they know they're musical and they know it's in their heart and they just need to be offered something a little different. And it's been kind of a dream of mine for a long time. I knew that there were lots of other students that could really benefit from these ideas, but they were going to probably be found in programs that didn't necessarily have the budget or the excess funds to be able to do something like hire clinicians or guest artists. That's feels like very much a luxury. So we decided, you know, we've never done a Kickstarter or crowdfunding or anything, which we're just lucky to have such loyal fans that way that keep coming to shows, and we haven't had a need to. But we started the Mox Project. It's a full-blown 501c3. And we have a board and everything, which was way more of an undertaking than we could have ever imagined. But we've been so thrilled, and everybody has just risen up and has given so graciously. So we've been able to donate about 13 clinics and offer some camp scholarships as well. So it's just the start of what hopefully will be a very fun journey.
Well, tell us where you will be performing next.
Yes, we will see you at the Arc on August 4th in Ann Arbor, which does feel very much like the hometown. I was at school when Allie and I really first started playing. So having been from Chelsea right next door and to have spent so much time writing these tunes and kind of developing the band in Ann Arbor, it'll be very much a homecoming for us.
Well, Diana Latio of the Moxie Strings joining us from Nashville, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, we'll talk to a Michigan State professor who researched the correlation between police shootings and race. We'll talk to him about what he found out next. Over the last several years, we've heard about many cases of white police officers shooting unarmed black citizens. A lot of debate has centered around what to do about it. Do we test police for implicit bias? Do we spend more time training police? Do we work harder to diversify police departments? Well, new research shows the premise of that debate is flawed. It shows white officers are not more likely to fatally shoot minority civilians compared to black or Hispanic officers. Joining me now is one of the researchers, Joseph Cesario. He's an associate professor of psychology at Michigan State University. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Lester. I really appreciate it.
How did you come to the conclusion that white officers don't shoot and kill people of color more often than officers of different races?
Sure. So the first thing that we had to do was to get a list of officers who have actually been involved in fatal officer-involved shootings. So it turns out that for various reasons, there are no federal databases of police officers, a complete federal databases of police officers who have shot and killed civilians in the United States. So our very first step was to create such a database. And we did that by looking at all known fatal shootings in 2015, and then contacting the police departments for information about all the officers who were involved in each shooting. We did that. We did follow-ups. We then did internet searches and newspaper articles to try to get as much data on the police officers involved as we possibly could. Then when we had enough data, and depending on what measure we looked at, race, sex, and years of experience of the police officers, when we had enough data to do this kind of analysis, we then asked whether it was the case that the race of the police officer related at all to the race of the person who was shot.
And it showed it did not.
That's correct.
I guess the question is, does your research show whether police officers, of all races, police officers, are more likely to shoot people of color than white people?
Right. In our analysis, which is similar to what we've done in the past, we've used a very different method here, but we found virtually the same results as we found in other work, is that no, in fact, once you take into account the various police-citizen contacts that exist, so exposure to the police through crime, once you take that into account, it did not look, in fact, that that officers were racially biased in the decision to use lethal force.
This has been published research. You know, of course, this flies in the face of conventional wisdom. What kind of feedback are you getting?
Well, it depends. Really, there's something to like and something to dislike, depending on what your sort of political leanings might be in these findings. And so some people have said, looked at or latched on to one aspect of the results and said, you know, that's what we've said all along, was that it isn't about a particular police officer. It's the entire institution, right? It's the color blue that is the problem, not the color of the officer. So some people have that reaction and have looked at the research positively in the sense of saying this confirms what we've thought all along about all police. The problem is with all police. other people have looked at it and said, well, actually, once you look and show that crime rates are really a strong correlate of being shot by the police, then actually that confirms what they've thought all along, which is that in fact, none of the officers are really showing racial bias in that decision. The principal problem is with crime.
We've heard about so many cases of white officers killing unarmed black people. Yours looked at all fatal shootings.
Correct.
What does your data show about that subset of fatal shootings, unarmed black people?
In that subset, we came to the same conclusion that we've come to in all the research that we've done looking at these kinds of shootings, which is that the data are simply uncertain on that point. So we actually don't have an answer to the question of, on the narrow case of shootings of unarmed citizens, particularly shootings of unarmed citizens who aren't in any way aggressing against the police officer. So you can be unarmed, say, and standing on top of a police officer or kneeling on top of a police officer, punching them in the face, or knocking their head into the concrete. If you just look at the cases where, the really tragic, really horrendous cases, someone, gets shot when they're pulling out their wallet instead of a gun, those kinds of cases, we just don't have an answer because those cases are very, very rare. There just is not a lot of data on those kinds of cases, and so we can't draw a conclusion one way or the other.
You found another trend that's troubling, and that is the number of mental health cases that resulted in fatal officer shootings. What'd your data show?
Our data were, that was one something that was a bit surprising to us, was just the number of mental health cases, both where an individual was exhibiting mental health problems, so they might be schizophrenic, for example, and not able to really respond to the officer in a way that the officer would expect or comply with the officer's requests. And then also that comes out in what's known as suicide by cop, where a citizen intentionally antagonizes a police officer with the purpose of trying to get that police officer to shoot and kill them because they want to die by suicide. Or they want to die, but they don't want to take their own life in a direct way. And so there are very clear cases of this. For instance, a case where an individual drove up to a police station, took out a gun, was waving it around at the police officers, and then after he was shot and killed, they found a note in his car that he had written saying, "I'm sorry, I used you, I wanted to die," that sort of thing. So you get those cases, and there are a striking number of cases like that that include one of those two, up almost close to 50%, for example, when it comes to white citizens being shot by the police. We did find, similar to just the national statistics where whites are more likely to, for instance, commit suicide than black or Hispanic citizens, we found that also, that cases such as suicide by cop were more common among white citizens than black or Hispanic citizens.
You mentioned earlier there really have been no records on these things kept centrally. I guess that's starting now with the FBI, but that's fairly recent. So what does your data show for 2015? What does it mean for reducing the number of fatal shootings of people by police? What can we do with that data?
Well, what we can first do is say what would be unlikely to work, at least what do the data suggest would be unlikely to work. And what the data suggest is that on its own, diversifying police forces will not reduce the number of fatal shootings of minority citizens, or it would be quite unlikely to do so directly. The diversity in police forces and diversifying the police forces, having police forces that look like the populations that they serve in terms of whatever demographics you want, those might have very positive effects in a lot of different ways, say police community relations or community trust in the police, police legitimacy. Those may be affected by that. But purely on the question of fatal shootings of citizens, it's unlikely that that's going to have much of a direct effect. What the data suggests, and again, this is consistent with our other research, is that to the extent that crime is really the context in which fatal police shootings occur, and that is the context in the far, far majority of cases, reduction in crime is going to be the number one factor. When you look and see that, somewhere, it depends on which database you're using and which estimate, but something along the lines of probably 90% or so of citizens shot by the police are themselves armed, at the time of the shooting. That tells you what is going to give you the biggest movement on reducing that in the number of shootings.
Joseph Cesario is an associate professor of psychology at Michigan State University. He and David Johnson of the University of Maryland are the lead researchers in a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Thanks very much for taking the time.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Lester.
This week, a state appeals court ruled that the state of Michigan has not been paying local governments in the way that's required by the state constitution. Lawyers and experts are sorting out exactly what that might mean for the state and for local governments. But frankly, unless you're steeped in state budget dealings, it's really confusing. So we've got the guys to help us get through this. At least I hope I do. Here's Brandon Dillon, a former Democratic legislator and former Michigan Democratic Party chair, and Ken Sikma. He's our senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the Michigan State Senate. They are our Friday political commentators. Brandon, the plaintiff in this case is a group that represents local government. They sued the state. What was the complaint about?
Well, the complaint is fairly simple, even if the decision is confusing. The complaint basically states that the state was shortchanging local units of government and not paying them the required percentage of state revenue that is required under the Headley Amendment, essentially arguing that they were counting state mandates that provided funding with it towards that cap, and the court ruled that they can't do that, amongst other things.
Basically, the state had to pay for state mandated.
That is correct, that shouldn't be counted towards the contribution the state makes to local government because it's asking local governments to carry out things that they're telling them to do, not things that they're doing in their own local government activities.
Ken, how was this originally put together under the Headley Amendment? Did it, from the beginning, use school funding as well in its calculation?
Well, the Headley Amendment, which was adopted in 1978, has got a lot of pieces to it. But in terms of this issue, it, number one, it establishes a floor below the which the state cannot go in terms of funding, as Brandon said. And then it also says any mandate from the state to local governments has to be funded by the state. Now, this court decision, you know, let me just say this. The best court decisions provide certainty and clarity on an issue, and this one just doesn't do that. But the only thing you could say about this decision is nobody knows what it means. Now, it is a little deja vu all over again, because 20 years ago we had a very similar case. It was called the Durant decision, dealt with the Headley Amendment. It dealt with the state underfunding local school districts in terms of special education, and the state Supreme Court at the time made a very clear decision, and the state was in the wrong, and the state had to come up with money to cover past underpayments to the tune of about $850 million over the course of 2 to 3 years. So in comparison, this decision is just really muddled. In part, it's an appellate court decision and hasn't gone to the Supreme Court yet.
If the state does not appeal this ruling and starts paying local governments for the cost of state mandates, what kind of money are we talking about?
Well, I think it also depends on if the plaintiffs choose to appeal the part of the case that said that the state prevailed in when it comes to school districts. I don't think it's clear how much it's going to cost, and the state is going to have a decision to make. Do they want to appeal, which could provide some political problems, looking like you're trying to shortchange local governments, and then weigh that against what it's actually going to cost. So I don't know what the cost is, but it's probably not likely as high as the direct case that Ken cited.
Lester, the state's not going to start cutting checks until Michigan Supreme Court tells them to. I mean, it's just that simple. And this particular decision is so muddled that the plaintiffs might appeal, not just the state in this case, the defendant, but, you know, the aggrieved local governments. They might appeal the case because they don't like it. Long run, if there is an impact on the state budget, you know, that's going to be important, because any potential impact has got to be looked at in the context of the legislature and the governor contemplating how to fund road repairs. And, you know, this is an indication that occasionally there's unanticipated demands on the state budget that you need to think about long term.
All right, guys, this whole thing seems clear as mud to me, but thanks for the attempt.
Well, as Ken said, it's a decision that doesn't provide a lot of clarity, and at the end of the day, there's going to be the Supreme Court weighing in on at least a portion of this case.
Yeah, and I agree with Brandon. I mean, so Supreme Court's going to be the final arbiter here, and until that happens, if it happens, you know, people just aren't going to know what this means.
Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the Michigan State Senate. Brandon Dillon is a former Democratic legislator and former Michigan Democratic Party chair. Thanks, gentlemen. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings, and I'm Lester Graham with another episode of Cheers to Michigan. Before you start mixing this, I see you've got some kind of soft drink you're going to use. What is that?
So this is from Casamara Club. They're a Detroit-based company, and they're making what they call Amaro sodas.
Interesting, and they've got a variety of them here. We're going to taste one of them, right?
Right. We're going to taste the one called Alta, which is the one we're mixing with today. But all of their products are really interesting. We've talked about Amaros on the show before. They're those Italian bittersweet after-dinner drinks. They use a lot of different botanicals that often have bitter or complex herbal flavors. And so here they're taking those, turning them into tinctures, and then using them in a soft drink.
Okay. Are you going to open that one for me?
Yes, I am going to open this one. We're going to taste the Alta because that's what we're going to use in our cocktail today.
And these are non-alcoholic.
Non-alcoholic. They're really designed for people who want to drink a little less but still have something that's got great flavor, is interesting, and not too sweet. These are just slightly sweetened.
Oh, I like that because it's not sweet. I get so tired of super, super, super sweet. That's barely got any sweetness to it, but it's definitely got that Amaro kick, I'll call it, the bitterness that I really enjoy.
Agreed. I like it a lot myself.
What are you using this in?
I'm going to take my inspiration from Italy, and we're going to make a little Michigan twist on the most popular cocktail in Italy.
That seems like an easy drink to make.
It really is. Just like an Aperol Spritz, we're just going to build it in a wine glass over a big pile of ice and then enjoy it while doing nothing at all.
What else did you put in there besides that soft drink?
So it was 1.5 ounces of Aperol. And then 1 ounce of gin. I used the Gin Stash gin from Rusted Crow Distillery. And then just topped it off with 4 ounces of the Alta.
Now, is there anything special about this gin? Is it a London dry gin or something else?
Very similar to a London dry gin. I would say it's really a great, straightforward mixing gin. It works in a lot of different cocktails, and it doesn't have any really unusual botanicals that might make it not work with other flavors.
A flexible gin.
Flexible and delicious. Oh, and I forgot to mention, don't forget the lemon wedge. I think that really makes the drink when you squeeze a nice, healthy wedge of lemon in there and then drop that right into the glass.
I have seen so many drinks where when you put the garnish or the bit of fruit in there, the citrus in there, it always makes it just a little bit better than you thought was possible. So we'll see how that turns out here.
And that's right. This drink doesn't have any acid in it, doesn't have any citrus in it. The sodas themselves don't have any tartness to them. So that little bit of citrus there is just going to brighten it up.
All right, let's see. You know, if I didn't know what you'd done, I would be convinced there was some kind of Amaro in there.
Well, there is. The Aperol is an Amaro, but it's a fairly light and fruity and sweet Amaro, and so by using Alta instead of the usual mix of club soda and Prosecco, we're bringing even more of those herbal, earthy, botanical flavors.
So I'm surprised about these soft drinks. I've not actually seen anything quite like this, especially since they're not very sweet, but they have a lot of flavor. Where'd this idea come from?
Well, if you think about it, this is really what pharmacists used to do. When we think back to soda fountain era, they were taking herbal tinctures and botanicals, and they were mixing them with something, usually some sugar. And that's where things like Coca-Cola and Dr. Pepper came from. And so this is just taking that same philosophy and bringing it into the modern era.
It'd be great to see what else can be done with these soft drinks, because they seem like they'd have a lot of potential since there's so many kinds.
4 different flavors. And what I like about them from the perspective of mixing into drinks is that most soft drinks have a lot of sugar in them already. And so if you combine them with any ingredients that are sweet, it doesn't work. With these, because they don't have any sweetness of their own, they're a really great avenue to add flavor without more sugar.
So what's this drink called?
I'm calling it the Alta Spritz in honor of the Alta drink.
Ah, very nice. Cheers.
Cheers.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.